Did you know over the course of 12 seasons of Murder, She Wrote, Jessica Fletcher solved nearly 300 murders, and 28 of those victims were close friends of hers? That's one woman I wouldn't want to hang around with. Despite the absurdity of amateur sleuths, they're damn fun and one of my favorite types of mysteries. My guest, Elizabeth Sims, writes a great series with Lillian Bird, who happens to be one of those poor souls who can't seem to go about life without stumbling on bodies on a regular basis. Listen in on the fun as we talk about that and much more.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, this is Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. You know, in my introduction, Elizabeth, I referred to Lillian Bird as an amateur sleuth, but she's actually a reporter, so that's not entirely true, is it?
Oh, you know, she's certainly amateurish, and she makes a lot of bad decisions and gets into various bits of trouble here and there. She's fairly good at getting out of that trouble, though. She's nominally a reporter. She's an investigative journalist, as she would call herself, as self-styled, I guess. She had a steady paycheck for a while until things went wrong in the first book, Holy Hell, where the boss's son at the newspaper she worked for took too many liberties with her, and so she wound up stabbing him with an X-Acto knife in his rear end. Got fired for that. So her paycheck disappeared, but then she just tries to and kind of strings together jobs for the local, I guess it's a slick independent called Motor City Journal, which is a fictitious organization, but the boss there throws her different bones, and if she can come up with some interesting stories, then she gets paid for that. So she's really just kind of stringing it along.
I have never stuck my boss with a X-Acto knife in the ass, but I would say that's probably the end of the job.
Yeah, it was the boss's son, which is like even perhaps worse than the boss. That really didn't work out very well for her, even though she was very well justified in doing that. But so it goes.
The guest I'm chatting with right now is Elizabeth Sims. She is a Lambda Literary Award winner and a Goldie Award winner. She is most known for her Lillian Bird and her Rita Farmer mystery series. Any reader of Writer's Digest should recognize her name as well. Her most recent novel is Tight Race, which is book 6 in her Lillian Bird series. So now, a formal welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brad. I'm honored to be with you today.
Well, I want to tell you, certain times we have our book recommendations. We never do book reviews here, but we do book recommendations. But in my interviews, I try to do the verbal equivalent of a poker face because I allow my guests to introduce themselves, because whether a book is good or bad can be so subjective. Mm-hmm. But however, I am a weak man. I have to tell you, sometimes I can't hold back. I adored Tight Race, and I am in love with Lillian Bird.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
And I also want to thank you. One of my big pet peeves, and I'm sure listeners are tired of hearing it, is series novels that you have to read them all to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And this book is clear a standalone. And in fact, I knew it was book number 6, but I actually checked a couple of times to make sure I was right, because it was any book you could pull off the shelf and start reading. So good job, and thank you for doing that.
Sure. Yeah, all of them are pretty. All of them can stand alone. I really wanted to make it that there wasn't, you know, that you didn't have to read from the beginning to enjoy one or the other. Yes, yeah, thanks. That was definitely a deliberate thing.
And also, where you succeeded is, I understood Lillian. I knew where she was coming from, but I didn't get a long, boring backstory.
Right.
So, good job on that.
Thanks.
As well.
Thanks.
Now, on Elizabeth's behalf, I'm sure she won't complain if you go buy book number 1, Holy Hell, but you will not be disappointed if you go straight to Tight Race. And I'll tell you, just go ahead and buy 1 through 6. She'll be thrilled with that.
Super. Yes, and thank you in advance, all you folks out in Radio Land.
We met in kind of an unusual way, Elizabeth. I was looking for a new editor, and another author said, I know somebody that's great. You need to go check out Elizabeth Sims. I went and checked out your website to see about your editing services, and I saw the drop-down box where it said books. And I'm like, oh my God, it's that Elizabeth Sims. She's got to be on this show.
Oh, how nice. That's very nice. Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of some, it's irrelevant. I'm sorry. I don't need to interject with a little story about my Rita series, but anyway, go on. Sorry.
No, go ahead and interject.
It has to do with the, you know, are you the, a friend of mine happens to be I'm afraid she's passed on by now, but we were good friends and she was a doctor and she helped me in a number of my books, mostly the Rita Farmer books that I wrote in the late aughts and into the tens. She helped me with some medical details and she also was a musician, as was I, that was how we met. And at one point, she was playing in a small ensemble, and after the concert got done, a woman came up to her and said, "You, Dr. Baker?" She says, "Yes. Are you Margaret Baker, M.D.?" She says, "Yes, I am." She says, "Are you the Margaret Baker, M.D.?" And she said, "Well, I am Margaret Baker, M.D., but I there might be more doctors by my name in the U.S. or somewhere, I don't know." And the woman said, "Well, are you the Margaret Baker, M.D., that Elizabeth Sims thanked in her book, The Extra, the Rita Farmer book? Are you that doctor?" And she said, "Yes, I am." She said, "Wow." So, it's like totally irrelevant to anything. The, you know, how much individual perception shapes our experience of others, you know?
It's totally relevant. I am so surprised that somebody would remember a person mentioned in your acknowledgments.
Yeah, it's like insane. You know, this woman must have, you know, like really gotten into it, into the book. You know, so
yeah. I actually read acknowledgments, but I would say probably within 5 minutes, I've forgotten.
Right.
Unless it's somebody I really know well. Mm-hmm. But I will say, as far as you being an editor, if you become my editor, mm-hmm. Dharma Kelleher recently wrote a book called Breakthrough, and it's about overcoming imposter syndrome. I wrote the foreword to it. I was very honored, and I highly recommend it to any writer. But despite having read her book and written the foreword, after reading Tight Race, I'm absolutely terrified of you looking at a manuscript of mine.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you just have to get over that, Brad. I happen to have a talent for editing. And so I like to help people doing it, although I'm probably not going to be doing it for very much longer. I'm going to try to celebrate my 65th birthday coming up this year by stopping doing editing and concentrating much more fully on my own work. So anyway, that's just a little aside. I really shouldn't have even said how old I am. I'm supposed to see, my mother always lied about her age, and then she lied about her children's ages. And so I tried to, because once you get too old, you know, you have to start lying about your kids' ages. You can't say you've got a 50-year-old kid if you're trying to act, you know, pass off as 65. But that's the case. I was talking about editing and how I do have somewhat of a talent for it, as it turns out. And like I say, I do like to help people with it. And what the folks I like to help the most are writers who already have some level of talent, and I can kind of help them get to a level that they're aspiring to, but might be a little bit stuck on how to get there.
Well, first I want to tell you to give your age that you're 65.
64, but I'll be 65.
I'm sorry. Okay, 64.
Yes.
In 2022, it's not a big deal anymore.
I guess
you know, it wasn't that long ago when 65 would have meant you're wearing a frumpy house dress and
right.
Wearing your slippers and
yeah.
People just looked old.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, folks, I'm looking at her now. She's vibrant. So.
You're very kind. And I'm very lucky to not look my age. That's true, too. I try to stay active. And this is actually my natural hair color. Folks out there can't see this. But I have a few gray streaks. My parents both looked younger than their years as they got older. So I'm lucky in that way. But yeah, you're right that these days, it's so funny. I think about my parents and how and their behavior and their aspect as they aged. And even though both of them were, you know, in good shape, and my father died a little too young, not of natural causes, which is a whole story. But yet, you could look at him and think, yeah, sort of old person. But, you know, I look at myself and some of my friends, and we're much more, you know, active and youthful seeming, I guess. And it might have to do with fashion, I guess. But it also, I think, does have to do with a bit of a mindset of the more modern mindset. You know, there's more things available to a person as one ages. There's no stigma about going and getting a college degree at starting at age 55 or higher, something like that. So, and of course, we know more, you know, medically and physiologically about how great it is to be active and stay active as one gets older, instead of just sort of sit there and, you know, pet the cat and bake cookies for the grandkids, let's say. Not that there's anything wrong with either of those two things.
I am the exact same age right now as my mom was when she died. Mm. And she was, I'm not going to say an old lady, but she did look like an older housewife, which she was. So, yeah, it's really changed, I think, much for the better.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. It's easy by clicking Love the Podcast in the show notes. If you prefer another app, you can click the same link to see if they offer them. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.
Now, going back to you as an editor, being an author and an editor, what are the pluses and the minuses doing dual roles?
I kind of got into it by accident, really, because so I started out, you know, being an author, and then I started realizing that I had some ideas that I thought could help other writers. And I used to subscribe to this magazine called Writer's Digest Magazine, and I found helpful things in there. And I thought, well, you know, I've got a few books under my belt now, which would be the first few in the Lillian series that we talked about earlier. I thought, well, you know, let me just write this up, or, you know, kind of let me inquire with this magazine, see if they think my ideas are worth, you know, me writing an article about. And they just, this is kind of interesting as far as doing freelance work. I sent an inquiry. This was already in the days of email, thank goodness. And I said, I have this idea about an article I'd like to write for you guys. Here's who I am. And by the way, I also have down at the bottom of the email, I said, and I could also, if you don't like that one, I have these other ideas very quickly, just little bits. And so they got back to me. They said that the editor at the time said, well, your first idea, your main one sucks, but I like the second one that in your little list at the bottom. Do you think you could write me 1,200 words on that? And I go, yes, I can. So that started way back in 2006, me writing for that magazine. And one thing led to another. I kept writing more and more for them, and they liked what I wrote and put together. And then I became a contributing editor, which is basically kind of a title more than anything, but it you agree to write only for that magazine on writing. And then they agree to give you first consideration for pieces. And I also get a little bit more money per word than non-contributing editors. That's kind of how that works. And then readers of that magazine got in touch with me occasionally to say, hey, you know, I like your work in the magazine. Do you think you could help me with my novel coming along? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I could, and kind of put together a fee structure. And so then I formalized it a bit more on my website and have been doing that kind of work as a sideline ever since. Because, I mean, you know, unless you're one of the fortunate few who's quite successful, you know, whose books do very well financially, you kind of got to cast around for other work to do. So this has been helpful to me. And then I kind of have a bit of a gig with a publisher, a small one of queer publishers, and they'll send me work. They're the authors that they consider their top authors, and they want to really make their books shine. And so I'm flattered that they feel I can help with that, and I do.
I'm probably like a lot of people, I would guess here. I was a subscriber to Writer's Digest decades ago. And read it and thought it was wonderful. Now that I'm an author, I don't read it. And you have reminded me I need to subscribe to it, because it really is a great magazine.
They do have, and I think they're getting better and better over time. They've adjusted with the times, and they also are attracting more and more different writers, so that's nice. And I realize that I didn't exactly answer your question about the, you know, kind of the pros and cons of being a writer and an editor, too. So, I mean, if I could kind of go back to that for a moment.
Sure.
You know, the pros are, of course, it helps my income because as much as I'd like to do it for free, I just can't. And it's quite time consuming. Editing is really quite time consuming. If you want to do a good job, it takes time. I always like to, in all aspects of life, under promise and over deliver, you know, as opposed to the opposite, which is kind of the con artist way to go. So the pro, and another pro is that I get to see other people's work and I get to see what people are doing, and, which, sometimes is disheartening if the person it's really tough if I've got a client, you know, they want to make it the best they can, they feel I can help them, and I know I can help them make it better than it is, but whether it can be in any sense of the word publishable, in some cases it's just pretty sad. But I still try to help them because, well, they might put it out themselves, and at least it's going to be better than it was in the first place. So that is a bit of a downside. I mean, it's an upside to know that I've helped someone, and it's really an upside to hear back from an award-winning novelist or NYT best-selling novelist saying, "The notes you gave me on my book are the best I've ever gotten in my whole career." That, and I've heard that more than once, and that is very, I mean, you know, so here I am bragging about myself, but that's very rewarding. And on the other hand, yes, it's time-consuming, and sometimes it can be a bit of a downer because I'm like, man, I'm spending hours and hours and hours of my life on this manuscript that is never going to be anything much, because even though I'm going to give this person a whole bouquet of actionable items that can help make the book better, their talent is at a level that they're not going to be able to execute much that I'm going to try to advocate for them to do. So that, you know, so yeah, you know, as in any kind of creative endeavor, when you are, or even, you know, teaching, I mean, and I've been an adjunct professor at a college in Florida. I did that for a while in the creative writing department. And, you know, I mean, you've got some students who are going to shine and some who are just not going to be brought along no matter what you do. And that's just life, you know. So.
Well, and it's okay to brag about yourself. Artistic people tend to not like to sell and market themselves.
Yes.
Unfortunately, as authors, it's our job to do that as well. It's the job we hate, but we have to do it.
Right.
So good job sliding that in there.
Thank you.
You did that very well. So, you know, we probably should talk about Tight Race.
Sure.
Let me start by talking about The Grapes of Wrath. Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath is my favorite novel of all time.
That's wonderful. I'm a huge fan of it. Please go on.
In general, when it comes to writing, Hemingway's minimalist style, where I can fill in the blanks, is what I prefer overall.
Ah. He's a big favorite of mine, too. Go ahead.
So when I started reading the novel, I got a little nervous because the story began with a description of Marie Chamberlain. Or Chamberlain? Yes.
That's right.
And I thought, oh, dear, here we go. But you did it just right. I will tell you, I was hooked from the first page. Just hooked. And you did the same thing with Lillian. In very few words, I see her clear as day. So tell me, what is your writing style? What's your voice?
Golly. First of all, thank you for those compliments. When you started reading the description of Marie, did you think, and you said, oh, here we go. Did you mean like, oh, too much description?
Yes.
Or something like that? That you thought was going to,
yes,
maybe happen?
Yes, because it sounded like you were going to go really deep in her description. And really, I think it was just her hair and maybe your, you know, but my initial thought was you were going in that direction and then you didn't. I don't know why.
No, that's okay. And that's interesting because I actually did have more description and backstory about Marie in that first chapter in my earlier drafts. And I cut a bunch of it because I thought, yeah, this is just getting sludgy here, you know, even though I'm having fun describing this person. So, one has to be, you know, one has to be a bit strict with oneself. And that's something that comes with experience as an author. You know, you just get a feel for it. You look over what you've written, you know, what you wrote 2 weeks ago, and you're like, okay, this is good, this is not so good. And why, how do you know that? It's very hard to objectively explain why I know I need to cut back the description here on this person. How much to cut it back? Well, how many words at while do you have to cut? You know, if it's 300 words, do you cut, you know, 100 words or 101 words? I mean, you know, you can't quantify it very much, but that's art, you know? I mean, that's, you know, a painter looking at a picture and saying, okay, the mouth isn't right. I need to make a line right here, and all of a sudden it's perfect, or whatever. So yeah, the creative process is endless mystery, but it if one is patient with oneself and diligent about continuing to apply oneself and learning, then you can get better. You really can. So, and now did I get off the topic here? Oh, so you were asking me about, you know, process and style, I guess, style, tone, you know, how do I go about these things? Well, you know, well, I guess I partly answered that, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you covered it pretty well.
In that the voice in the Lillian books is, of course, they are written in first person, and so you are hearing the narrator is the main character, and she is telling you about what she is doing every day and how things are unfolding in these different pieces of her life and the activities that she pursues. So I've kind of put her together as an alter ego of myself in a way, and I certainly started out the first book not knowing how many books there'd be in the series or what would happen or whether that book would ever get published or anything, but I started out using a couple of nuggets of actual experience I had as a reporter. You know, Lillian starts, as I mentioned earlier, as a reporter for this small newspaper, and she gets fired from that job by basically standing up for herself against the grabby-handed boss's son. And she then gets drawn into a murder investigation because she happens to have some knowledge of who this anonymous victim is that turns up on the outskirts of town. And I based some of that on the one murder case I actually covered as a reporter in this little town. A body was dumped on the outskirts, and no one knew who it was. There was no identification. It was a man. And I saw the police photos, and the police gave me a photo that, they let me see the photos, and then they gave me a sketch that was done by one of the state police artists based on one of the photo of the dead guy's face. And this was, they said, would you run this in the paper so that, you know, maybe if somebody knows this guy, they can come forward. And so I did. And I don't know that it was ever solved, because it certainly wasn't solved in the couple of years I worked at that paper. But it set me to thinking about, you know, how I might introduce a crime in this novel that I thought.
So that experience gave you at least a little bit to help you out in writing this series.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you learn, you know, it's interesting when you work as a reporter, no matter where you are, and most reporters start out small, in either a small town or a small radio station or what have you, or a small job in a, you know, bigger concern, you learn a lot about how governments work, how city governments work, town, village governments work, and then you also learn how they really work, you know. And that's been very helpful to me. Just the short few years I spent doing that were as much of a better education than getting a degree from a university, frankly.
Well, it's funny. In my novels, I did just give basic descriptions because I like to let the readers fill in the blanks. And I have had people say, I wish you would have told me more what he looks like. Okay. And that's fine. That's the way they like to read. And it makes me think of Lawrence Block, my favorite author, and his burglar series.
Okay.
Now, Bernie the Burglar, I read the entire series, and I can picture Bernie clear as day, without a doubt. And it wasn't until the very last, quite a while after I read the last book, that I learned in an article that he never described Bernie in that entire series.
Ah, that's fabulous. Yeah, and you know, and of course, and you know, as an author, you know that you're writing to different readers, of course, and the readers are going to bring any number of variations of their own experience to what you're doing. And you happened to be a reader who who has an imagination and who applies his imagination to what he reads. And not all readers, of course, are that exact same way. And so I find it interesting that you said that. So it tells me that you do have an active imagination, and I imagine that your writing is perhaps better than you fear it might be, you know. So there you go. And that's interesting. I didn't know that about Lawrence Black and that hero. That's really funny.
You said, I'm sure there are readers who would read that and toss it aside. You know, it's just not their thing.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Right. Not all material speaks to all people. That's for sure.
So you touched on her a little bit, but tell us more. Who is Lillian Bird? What makes her tick?
Yeah, she is unlike some of the heroes and heroines of, if I may be binary there, of fiction, who I got a little smile out of you there, I see, of fiction, who are the dashing trust funders or, you know, very, very well off, and their financial position helps them do their crime busting thing or their investigation thing. She's almost always pretty close to broke, and she's always kind of scrounging, and, you know, she's always got to driving a secondhand car that used to be a police car. She buys them at these auctions, and, you know, and she wears jeans and sneakers, and she's got one wool pea coat, and, you know, but she never goes hungry, and she's, you know, she has this pet rabbit, and she, you know, is able to care for the pet. In a way, I'd say she's a seeker. She's always there. She's actually a mix of street smart and naive, and you might think, how can that be? But I see you nodding your head here, and I know our listeners can't see this, and I think that you may have kind of perceived that a bit, and when I just articulated it, it kind of resonated with you. So that, you know, it's like, you know, she's had a lot of different experiences, but her heart is kind of pure, you know, and she's always looking for the best in people, and she's looking for true love, but she also knows that life's not fair, and, you know, you can't expect a whole lot. You kind of get out of it what you give to it. So, and she's interested in things. She has a morbid streak of curiosity, you know, and I certainly do. And I mentioned she's my alter ego. So yeah, I send her off on these adventures that I might not have quite the same amount of guts to go on, or foolishness, however one might put it. But she really likes to plunge forward, and she may not be totally prepared to do something, but it needs to be done. And, well, by golly, I'm just going to jump right in here and, you know, see what happens.
And you said it perfectly. She has that rough exterior. She seemed like a hard ass, but there is that soft, squishy inside. I really enjoyed that. So let's talk about Tight Race. Tell us as much about the story as you can. Don't tell the ending.
No. He gets a lobotomy at the end. That was my brother was standing in line with a ticket waiting to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with his wife many years ago when that movie came out. And a guy came out of the theater and yelled, "He gets a lobotomy at the end." And my brother, you know, had he not been a law-abiding citizen, I think he would have throttled that guy on the spot. So he gets a lobotomy at the end is one of my favorite little, you know, stupid throwaway lines. So Tight Race is all the Lillian series occurs either in whole or part in the Detroit area, in and around Detroit, and so which is the major city in Michigan. It's not the capital city, which is Lansing, but it's the biggest city in the state. And most folks are aware that Detroit has had its problems and its ups and downs. Lillian in this book starts out being the media manager for a man who is running for mayor of Detroit. Detroit has had its problems with corruption, with crime, and lots of troubles. There's a lot of generational poverty in Detroit. There's bad weather sometimes. the winters can be a bit rough. But so this man, Leon Sorrell, who is trying to become mayor, he's a former police lieutenant, and he is aware of corruption in City Hall and in the police department, and he wants to clean things up and help be a moral leader for the town, not just try to be an administrator. And Lillian is quite attracted by that, and she helps him. And while this is while she's helping him, she winds up in a love affair with his campaign manager. And that doesn't go very well. A murder occurs, and Lillian discovers this murder scene, and she gets drawn into it. She is a suspect, actually, for a bit of time. And she wonders who really did it, because she knows she didn't. So there's and then, of course, because this is a queer novel and readers expect this, and I like to provide it, there is a love interest comes along who is one of the police detectives on the case. And this police detective and Lillian wind up being attracted to each other. And in this case, in this one, there is not much explicit love scene stuff as in some of my past books. I wanted this one to go more slowly because I wanted this one to be more meaningful to Lillian than the past ones have been. So that's a part of the plot. The opponent of Lillian's candidate is the incumbent, who is a woman, and it's called Tight Race. A couple of different meanings there. Of course, it's a tight political race. There's not a lot of politics in it. There's not Republican versus Democrat. Both of these candidates are independents, and they're just different. And the incumbent, of course, wants to keep her incumbency, and she happens to be white of Greek descent, as many Detroiters are. Actually, it's fairly large Greek population, population of Greek descent in Detroit. It's a little Greek town. And her opponent, Leon Sorrell, is a black guy, who, this is the former police lieutenant. So there's some treatment of racial issues, not all that much. And Lillian is a white woman, white queer woman. And she is able, because she has a good relationship with her candidate, she's able to talk with him a little bit about race and racial issues, and because they're buddies, and there's not any danger, you know, for anybody to talk about these things. And so she tries to be frank about these things and relationship with her boss and with those she comes in contact with in the city. So there's a little bit about that, and about the struggles of Detroit, and about a bit of a light at the end of a tunnel that there might be really happening for Detroit these days. Many dark days, but there's a lot of people of all colors and beliefs working to make things better. There's still a long way to go, especially in the neighborhoods. There's a lot of good, both good intentions and good actions going on. That's happening. And I also put in a subplot having to do with cultural appropriation. And it has to do with Lillian's aunt, who enters a macrame dog sweater into a competition, and she is there's comic relief. I mean, one thing. I mean, I do try to be. I mean, my humor comes through in my writing, and I think you can see this in my work in this book, Tight Race. Okay, so Aunt Rosalie enters this dog sweater into the macrame competition, and she finds herself on the receiving end of some very, very actually hateful censure from some of the other macrame artists in this organization. The Quad State Macrame Society, I can't remember what I named it anyway, it's a fictional organization. And she's attacked because she uses symbols and colors and emblems on this sweater that certain macrame artists decide are not hers to use. You know, there are the colors of some African nation flags. There's some symbols that are used by native peoples around the globe. And it's like all this lady wanted to do is make a sweater that looks nice for this dog next door and maybe win a prize for it in this competition. And she's clueless. She's this clueless old lady. So she's getting raked over the coals for nothing that she even knew she was doing. And so because my own sensibilities get like stretched thin by the overly woke culture, I guess I'll say, at the risk of, you know, I don't know what, censure against myself here. I just wanted to poke fun a little bit, I guess, at the whole, at all the outrage that happens against folks who don't mean any harm by what they do and aren't even causing any harm.
There's an old episode of Murphy Brown I love where she created a women's study program at her college. And so she goes back to it and she's sitting there with the women and they're talking. And one of the women says, I went by a construction site and I was so uncomfortable. And one of them said, oh, were they calling you names? No. Were they whistling at you? No. What was it? I just knew that they were looking at me that way. And Murphy Brown is like, no, this is not what I meant. This is not what I started. And well-intentioned, and yeah. Sometimes it's hard to keep that balance between the two.
And that's a good example, Brad, that you just said. So with the subplot, I wanted to just kind of poke fun at some of that. And so anyway, that's part of the book, and Lillian winds up actually helping her aunt a bit, as does her candidate buddy. And Lillian then winds up, you know, she winds up getting into a fair amount of trouble trying to figure out who committed this double murder at the beginning of the book. And then things work out, and I won't go into too much detail any more on that. But the basic thing is the good guy against entrenched corruption. That would be one. That's one major part of it, and then the subplot of the cultural appropriation, and then the two love stories that occur. So there you have it. It's a bouquet of marvelous writing. So everyone should run out and demand that their local bookstore carry it and buy it.
I agree. And you mentioned the humor, and that is one thing that really endeared me to this book. There were a couple of guffaws I had, but mostly it was just witty and understated.
Cute.
I started thinking of like McDonald's Fletch series, which I really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
But it's a comedic series. And then I mentioned Lawrence Block earlier, and he has Matthew Scudder, which is about as dark as it can get. Mm. You do this good balance in the middle. And in my opinion, I think that would be more difficult. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I really think it has to do with the personality of the author. I have tried to imagine myself writing a serious geopolitical thriller, you know, Earth in the Balance and, you know, that sort of thing. And I just, like, I can't do it, you know. I can't take – see, the thing is, I take my art and craft seriously, but I can't take myself all that seriously. And I think that comes out in my work. You know, it's just like, God, you know, let's have some fun here, you know. And that's my personality. I'll people will come over for dinner and we'll be talking and laughing and I say stuff that people find funny and I can't even remember what it was after the end of the evening. And they can't either. They just say, oh, you were so funny, but I don't know why or how, you know. So, you know, this is just the personality. And I've met some highly successful authors, some of these, let's say, guys who have written top selling these thriller series. And I won't say their names because I'm thinking of one in particular, and I'm like, God, he's such an overbearing idiot. Not idiot. I used a vulgar term.
You can be vulgar
in
here.
In my mind, he was like, and he seems like, you know, like this self-absorbed asshole, you know, who, God, you know, he took himself tremendously seriously. And I was just like, man, I don't even want to have a drink with this guy, you know. So it has to do with one's personality. And I kind of feel sorry for readers of authors who are these dead serious, types who just, man, I was like, where's the relief here? You know, they can't make fun of, you know, themselves or their material at all or their subjects, you know? And I realize that I'm like being nasty about other authors, and I don't really mean to be. There are many authors I admire who do have, you know, both the self-awareness and the talent to pull off some subtle humor or some wit, you know. Other than that, I guess that's about as best I can answer that one, yeah.
I have to commend you. You did a beautiful impersonation of William F. Buckley. For those of you too young to remember him, he was stuffy and very full of himself.
Yes. He certainly was, yes.
That's right. I'm going to steer us on a different route now because I really want to talk about your philosophy on life, which I just love. And I want to start with you worked on a sheep ranch for a while. Give us just a little bit about that. How long were you there and how did that happen?
Well, it was not a full-time position. I didn't live there. I was neighbors with, that doctor that I mentioned earlier. She and her wife had a ranch just on the other, across the ridge there from where my wife and I lived in Washington State. And they, so this was kind of a part-time thing for them. They had a small herd of sheep. The ewes were over on one side of the road and the rams were on the other side of the road because you keep them separate unless it's mating season and you want them to mate. And boy, it doesn't take long. They just send one ram over and he knows exactly what to do, even if he's never mated before, or even if he's the little young boy ram. Boy, they sure know. So they have that. And then they have llamas also for, to guard the sheep. Llamas will challenge a predator. If a coyote comes through the fence somehow, jumps over or gets through somehow, the llamas will challenge that. And cougars as well. And the cougar will win if they're very determined. But that's something that I learned about in hearing the llama alarm call. Because if you're there and you hear the llama alarming, one of the llamas alarming, you go and immediately and go see what's going on because something's going on. And then you might be able to save the situation if there's something deadly going on. So I was a neighbor. They called on me for help occasionally, and I would just keep coming over whenever they needed help for like lambing or if there was a difficult lambing situation. For shearing, I assisted in shearing, and I also assisted in slaughtering. I didn't do the slaughtering myself, but that they had some rescue sheep that they needed to slaughter, and they had a slaughterer come in, and then I just assisted with that, and they used the meat, but and the hides as well. But then I did actually euthanize a llama myself for them one day, and that was a pretty heavy experience. So I was basically kind of like a part-time hand, and they would throw me, you know, some bucks from time to time to help them, you know, and thanks for helping them out. And so that's kind of I literally did work on a sheep ranch, but I wasn't a full-time wrangler.
What's interesting to me about that is you're a city person, and a lot of folks from the big city would have not taken advantage of this, I think, an exciting opportunity, and you seized it. And like many people, probably like most people, there I had opportunities that I could have grabbed, and I didn't do it. And an example is, for whatever reason, I don't know, I always wanted to work on a shrimp boat.
Oh, cool.
I lived in North Carolina for a while, loved the coast, loved to go to the shrimp barges. And out of the blue, I got offered this job to work on a shrimp boat. You know, I got a little nervous and I didn't take it. And the reason I'm bringing up is the blog post that you submitted. Folks, go to the website and read her blog post, and you will see at the bottom there may be some free books that she offers if you read it. So make sure you read it and then take advantage of her offer. But in that blog post, which I found fascinating, you talk about a situation that was, you got yourself unwittingly into a dangerous situation, for lack of a better term, I'll say a long distance fan.
Yes.
And after you told the story, what I loved is you said, and these are the final words. I'm going to quote you verbatim from the blog. You said, "You can't control everything, and one must take risks here and there." And then added, "No matter who you are, at some point you have to decide to relax and enjoy the ride." I love that philosophy, and I want to know, did someone inspire that in you? Did it learn it? Did it come naturally? Where did that come from?
Gosh, you know, that's very, it's a kind of a moving question there, Brad, actually. Part of that comes from the fact that I, in my younger days, said no to some new experiences and opportunities and regretted it and regret to this day that I didn't do, you know, kind of say yes to certain things that I was like, wow, I probably should do that. Oh, well, you know, and then I come up with some, you know, reasons why not to. Well, And I think, yeah. So, but there have been times when I have gone ahead and done it, you know, like taken the leap or gone, well, yeah, okay, well, what the hell, you know, let's see what happens. And knowing that I have regrets from the past for not doing certain things and making certain choices, that always helps me. Now, is there, the older I get, the more I'm on the lookout for, you know, things to say yes to. So yeah, that, and the fact that, golly, you know, I mean, you know, we all are here for such a finite period of time. And, you know, another thing, I mean, I was working as a manager in big retail for a while, and I left that work to be a writer. And I have, and had I stayed in business management, I would be so much better off financially than I am now, because it's, you know, it's been most of the years has been quite a struggle to, you know, make ends meet. But I'm not dead yet, and I've got plans and more things, you know, lined up, and I'm working on things, and I keep learning, you know, how to do things well. So, you know, making the leap away from a paycheck, a very good paycheck, to total uncertainty was a big one. And I feel, and so sometimes I look back and I think, oh man, you know, why did I do that? Look where I'd be if I had, you know, financially. All I think about is, you know, along this line is, well, financially I'd be better off. Well, yeah, but I probably would have, you know, shot myself in the head with despair because of the, you know, soulless work that I was winding up getting deeper and deeper involved with. It's what, you know, as I say in my instructional title about writing, you've got a book in you. I say, you know, what did I want on my tombstone? You know, she was an executive vice president, or she went for it. And, you know, everything comes with a price. You know, it you know, riches from a corporate job come at a price, and artistic achievement comes at a price. So ideally, you know, you want a tombstone that says, the bitch could sell books and the bitch could write really well. That's, you want both of those things on your tombstone. You know, you don't want, you know, the bitch could sell schlocky books, or, you know, or she wrote great books that didn't sell. You want great books that sell. So anyway, that's what I keep on working on.
Well, I will tell you, based on my experience, my personal experience, you made the right decision. When I was a late teen and early college, Gary Trudeau, who writes Doonesbury, was my idol. And I decided I was going to be a comic strip artist. And so I wrote these comic strips that I just shared with friends. And I learned that even though I like both physical art, such as painting and sketching, I really enjoyed the stories more. And I said, I want to be a writer. Well, you know, one day I was working at a Hallmark store. A friend of mine managed it and she needed help. So I walked in, and a human resources director from a major hotel chain walked in, and we got into conversation. And next thing I know, I'm working as a bellman in the hotel.
Oh, wow.
And every promotion I went for, I got. So I was in the hotel business for 16 to 20 years. And when I left, I had a really nice position, you know, the secretary, all the things that you're supposed to have, the great big window. And I so wish I didn't talk to that woman that one day.
Wow.
But it looked good and the money was good, but it wasn't what was making me happy at all.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a good story. Yeah. But then, and then you got out.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. So now, I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but it is time for Awkward Questions Authors Get.
Okay.
And what I do is I spin a wheel and we will see what question you get. So are you ready?
Ready as I can be.
Okay, here we go. Okay. Congratulations. You sold the movie rights to a Lillian Bird novel. Who would you like to play the lead?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'm going to go back in time. I'm going to say, I think it's got to be Katharine Hepburn, you know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she.
Interesting choice. I don't think I would picture, but I can see why.
You know, I'm thinking of some, possibly, you know, possibly Candace Bergen. She could do it. I know there are current actresses going on today. Yeah. And, you know, Kate Blanchett, she's pretty good. You know, she'd be a possibility. So
you have a pretty good list there.
Yeah.
So one more time, what's the name of the novel?
The novel we've been talking about today?
Yes.
It is Tight Race. That is book six in the Lillian Bird series. And I might add that when this podcast goes live, the fifth in the series, the one just before that called Left Field, will be free on Amazon for an ebook. So folks can check it out. Check out Lillian for free.
Okay, these are going to be really busy show notes because I will make sure that is in the show notes. I'll make sure that I have the link to Elizabeth's website and I'll have a link to Tight Race. So I want to thank you very much for being a guest on the show. I'm so happy that I met you.
Very much ditto, Brad. It's been an honor talking with you, and I certainly hope that your listeners enjoy this podcast, and I know they'll certainly enjoy you as a host going forward, because I sure did.
Well, it's easy when I have a great guest.